So yeah, welcome everybody and welcome everyone online. I'm slightly wondering because we thinned out a bit here, so I'm wondering if some of us have popped up online. I think there has been a little bit of an exchange. Anyway, so it's my great delight to introduce Shantavadri today, this morning. And what could I say about Shantavadri? Let me count the ways. So Shantavadri, I've lived with Shantavadri for, I think we've lived with each other for 10 years now, haven't we? Which has been a really joyful experience in my life. It gives me a little happy feeling, you know, when I see a light on. Or we have this thing where we have a morning ritual of, there's not a great number of bathrooms in the community at Tea Rant the Loca, so it's often the case that I'm having a shower and she's brushing her teeth and we tell each other our dreams and then we swap round and she's in the shower and I'm brushing my teeth and kind of we do actually often talk while brushing the teeth, which is semi-effective. So Shantavadri's got a very wide experience of the movement, actually. So she's lived and worked in India, and Karuna Maya is her preceptor. And she's also worked, so she's a great linguist, Shantavadri, because she can speak all sorts of languages like Hindi and Nepali. It's great fun going to the local Nepalese restaurant in Brecon, because she'll start chatting away and they look a little confused. French and German. Anything else? A little bit of Spanish. And she worked at Karanar for many years, and then she worked at an Evolution. She's also worked in Evolution and at Lama's Pajamas before she came to Tea Rant the Loca. And I think, well, the fact that she's so good at languages does say something about Shantavadri, because she's really interested in people and she's interested in their lives, and she has a huge kind of feeling for people's lives and people's stories and, you know, their backgrounds and their families and everything about them. She really wants to know what makes people tick, you know, what motivates people. And really cares about their situations, cares very deeply. I've really seen that at Tea Rant the Loca, actually, caring for everybody. And this kind of search for what kind of wanting to go onto other people's mountains. She talks about that quite a lot, actually, Shantavadri, about going to other people's mountains. Understanding, sort of getting inside their lives. And she's a great boon to have at Tea Rant the Loca, partly because I think Shantavadri is motivated by a strong kind of inner delight. So some of you know that she also is a singer. She's got grade 8, which we were all immensely proud of while she was at Tea Rant the Loca. Grade 8 in whatever it is, singing. Is it classical singing? Anyway, so you can hear her doing her scales in the hut sometimes if you're at Tea Rant the Loca. But I think I remember talking to her about, you know, she was in the chapter when she decided to take brahmacharya vows, and she said, the reason that I can do this is because I feel such passion in my life, particularly in singing and music. And I think that's very evocative of what Shantavadri's like. She can take delight very easily in and sustain herself in that way. At the moment, she's been listening to Harry Potter on audiobooks, you know, and she just loves it. There's lots of things that Shantavadri just loves and takes delight in. And I think that's very good for us at Tea Rant the Loca, because we work very, very hard. And I think we need that realm which is non-utilitarian, you know, that's just about delighting in the arts and culture. And there's something about Shantavadri as well, which I really, really, really deeply trust Shantavadri. Yeah, so, you know, like, I know that if I'm going into a room, so there's this scenario and I think I've got this thing and I need to talk to someone. And I go into Shantavadri's room and she's got this lovely room. She's got this kind of oil burner thing going. So it smells really nice, except for when I come in with my black salt lemon soda and make her room smell of sulfur. But anyway, so before I come in, it smells really nice. And she you know that you can talk to her about what's important and she'll listen carefully and she'll give you the time And then she'll help you explore it in a way that is mutually arriving at the truth. So I think there's a real commitment to communication and harmony in the order for Shantavadri. That's really palpable. And I know that if I've got anything I'm struggling with, I can talk to her about it. And she's not going to make it easy for me, but also we can arrive collectively at the truth. And I think that real dedication to harmony is also because she's able to look at herself within that. She's very humble in a way, you know. She's really, really open to looking at her own motivations and what's going in herself, and really quick to apologise take a lesson from what's happened. So she's a very, very good person to talk about communication in coolers, in which she's done a lot of them. What's it called again?
Coolers and the Creative Mind.
Coolers and the Creative Mind, because I think Shantavadri definitely has an extremely creative mind.
Wow, what an introduction. I feel very moved, actually. How lovely. Thank you so much, Vajratara. Gosh. Yes, so I want to talk about coolers and the creative mind. So take my layers off. I'm taking them off, putting them back on, taking them off. Here we go. Get hot when I talk. When we were talking in the college cooler after the area order weekend about this theme, what theme we would do for this retreat, I knew that this was the area that I wanted to talk about. Coolers as a context for creative communication, for the darkening, for the esoteric sangha to refuge to arise. So a few weeks ago, I was visiting the Croydon Buddhist Centre with Suchimani. Where's Suchimani? There she is. And others from the Croydon Buddhist Centre and from the southern region. The southern region Dharmacharanis have put on events called Jewel Quest South. And they invite mitras from all over the region to various locations to do days together. And they'd invited me for that day. And it happened to be at the Croydon Buddhist Centre. There was about 25 mitras there and about half a dozen Dharmacharanis. It was great. I really enjoyed it, actually. And after various talks and things in the morning, we were in small groups to have discussions just about anything that had come out of the talks in the morning or anything that was on their minds as mitras had asked for ordination. And it became very apparent in my small group, people wanted to talk about coolers. That was a hot topic. People often do at Tiruvannamalai as well when you have like a Q&A. It's something that is very, very important for mitras in the ordination training process. How do you get a cooler? Who do you have in your cooler? How does a cooler operate? It's a big thing. And it can be very daunting for people as well, you know, as well as exciting. And one of the women in the group, who's actually quite an introverted woman and somebody who struggled, I think, socially a little bit, she was great. She was saying that she'd been really, really scared to get a cooler together, but she'd gone ahead and done it. And she said it had really been very, very positive. And it was fantastic to hear that from her in particular, actually. And I found myself saying to the women in that particular group that, yes, it's true that coolers can be very challenging. Definitely, for mitras can be very challenging. For older members, they can as well. But I was talking to them as well. And that they can be very positive. There's no guarantee about how they're going to go. They're not a kind of a safe process, if you like. And I realised afterwards, realised generally, that the reason why, well, they can be challenging, they can be positive, it's unknown how they're going to go, is because they're a context for creative communication. And with a creative process of any kind, by definition, we don't know what the outcome's going to be because it's bringing something new into being. I love the way that Bhante talks about the spiritual life. He's as we know, he's often compared it to the artistic process of being an artist, whether it's a creative, like a writer or a painter or whatever sort of artist, where, but particularly, I would imagine for him, you know, sitting with a blank sheet of paper not knowing what he was going to write. You just sit in front of the blank sheet of paper and something emerges and you don't know what it is. And it is like that, I think, the whole of the spiritual life's like that. But I think our communication in the Sangha is very much like that. Chapter meetings can be like that, particularly the chapters that don't have much of a formal structure. You just get there and it's a bit like there's a blank sheet of paper. There's, you know, you and your chapter buddies, you just don't know what's going to arise. And sometimes it can be, afterwards you can think, oh, I don't know, that wasn't that interesting or it wasn't that inspiring this time. And sometimes something can really come together. You know, something's co-created. But what exactly do I mean by creative? You know, what's the definition of creative in this context? Well, I've got this little project going on, apart from listening to all of Harry Potter's audiobooks read by Stephen Fry, which I really recommend, by the way. And I found there's a couple of places on the web where you can listen to them for free. They're fantastic. Kept me going all this winter. Apart from that, I've interspersed that with, I've got this little project of listening to all of Banti's lectures right from the very beginning. I just decided I was going to do it. It'll probably take me the rest of my life to listen to them because there's over 1,000 on Friedbuhdist Audio. And they start in 1965. So I've listened to all of 1965 and all of 1966. And I'm just getting into 1967, which is, of course, when the Friends of the Western Buddhist Order was founded. Hasn't been founded yet. He's still at the Hampstead Buddhist Vihara. And the next one I'm about to listen to is Mind Reactive and Creative. That's the next one, way back in 1967, before the movement and order were founded. Of course, it's a seminal lecture for the movement, for the order, but it is for me as well, I think. It's probably, for me, it's Banti's central teaching, which I keep going back to again and again and again. And interesting that it was given before the founding of the order. And his emphasis on the spiritual community in these lectures, his vision for the spiritual community, it was very palpable. He talks about it a lot, you know, even with the folk from the Hampstead Buddhist Vihara. And I can imagine it probably wasn't that satisfying for him. He probably didn't quite see it coming into being in the way that he dreamed it would until he actually started the order a couple of years later. Yeah. Anyway, as we know, the lecture describes the reactive mind and the creative mind. And he illustrates this by talking about the wheel of life and the spiral path. He talks about the spiral path not in terms of the 12 Nidanas, but in terms of the 7 Bodhyangas, just as a matter of interest. And then he talks a lot about the gap and about feeling, Vedana and Trishna, craving, you know, the gap between feeling and craving, and about the centrality of awareness for staying into the gap, staying in the gap and moving on to the spiral. So it's very, very familiar material to us. But anyway, yeah. With my paper here. Here we go. Yeah, so as I say, I think this is the most helpful model of the spiritual life for me. I just keep coming back to it again and again. It feels like what I'm trying to do with my whole life, but also in each moment, in each specific activity, each movement, if you like, however subtle, of body, speech, or even mind, trying to notice whether I'm in a creative or a reactive mental state and trying to use awareness as the tool to move from reactivity to creativity. So in a way, you can never be bored. I mean, that was one of the things that I realised when I really started to understand this teaching a bit more, was actually you need never be bored. There's always something to do, you know, watching one's mind and just noticing, you know, the endless play of the mind and whether it's reactive or creative. And clearly, creative mind isn't just about meditation or when we're walking around. Clearly, it also applies in communication, in verbal communication, written communication, formal, informal, with one individual, in a group, you know, the whole gamut, really. So, yes, I do find it a very exciting concept when applied to communication, because I think there's something about the spiral path and those positive factors arising in dependence upon conditions. So the lovely thing, I think, about communication as a kind of a vehicle for the spiral path to arise is that it's not just my tendencies that are giving rise, or my own sort of work, if you like, that gives rise to the positive, the spiral path. But also, within a communication, you, the people I'm communicating with, and the work that you're doing to bring about a creative response becomes a condition for my creativity to arise and become more intense. So it's kind of like it's an exponential growth in creativity, if you like. I do think that's why communication in the Sangha, I think that's probably technically how it works in terms of conditionality, you know, that there are a number of creative factors in present. And in a way, it's almost like, it's a bit difficult to say this without sort of getting a bit kind of confused, but it's in those moments, the fact that we're not separate selves is palpable. Because what's going on in your mind is having an effect on what's going on in my mind, even if it's not necessarily expressed. Mm-hmm. Pick it up and something arises out of it, which is much, much more, more powerful, has a much stronger momentum of creativity behind it than if I was just sitting in the, you know, in the privacy of my own mind. It's one of the things I often try to emphasise to mitras, is that it's fantastic to be skillful and to practice ethics and things like that with your friends, with your family, you know, your workmates and stuff like that. But it has a different quality if you do it in the Sangha, because everybody's trying to do the same. So it just has a lot more behind it. It can go a lot further. It's not just one person's effort. I do think that's, well, it's something that I've experienced many, many times, actually. Yeah. And I think for that reason, this sort of communication is a bit of an insight practice, in the sense that one can sort of actively experience non-fixed and separate self, non-fixed and separate other. You know, that division gets attenuated, and we can experience it. Yeah. So I wonder if this is how we think of coolers as being. If this is what we imagine when we are organising a cooler meeting or about to attend a cooler meeting, as an opportunity for the creative mind to arise, or for the positive spiral to arise. And I would like to suggest humbly that it needs to be. It needs to be how we think about cooler meetings and coolers. And if our experience of a cooler meeting isn't like this, we could ask ourselves, well, what was going on then for me in that cooler meeting? Was I reacting? And then you've got a whole load of a reflection that you can do around that. You know, what was going on? Why was I reacting? What was getting triggered in me, etc.? What could have been a more creative response? So, you know, there's always a load of opportunity in those sorts of meetings for us as order members, I'm thinking, particularly. I think it would be really great if we as an order could approach cooler meetings more consciously as primarily an opportunity for a creative mind, the creative mind to arise collectively amongst all present. That is the primary purpose of a cooler meeting. The purpose is to practice together, whether or not the mitra is present. But I think we can only do this if there's a shared understanding of what we're trying to do in a cooler meeting. There are various pitfalls, I think, in cooler meetings that I'm aware of, having experienced them and heard about them, that we could avoid if we just were a bit more conscious, I think, about what we're about in cooler meetings and what helps. And I think it's also important that we train new order members in this area. Mm-hmm. And I have to say, I do think it's our responsibility as preceptors to take a bit of a lead with that. I think it would, you know, make a real difference if we did take that on, all of us. Not that we aren't, but just if we could do that a bit more. So when I was thinking about the sort of things that can help, or the pitfalls, yes, I think we need to understand what the purpose of a cooler meeting is, or even what the purpose of a cooler is, that gathering of Dharmacharinis, or even Dharmacharis when they're there. It's very, very hard for the Mitra to know this. In fact, it's not possible for her to know this, particularly when she's new in the ordination process. It's going to be very, very different from other contexts that she's been in that might seem similar to her, but they are quite different. They have quite a different purpose. So two of the common misperceptions that I've come across for what a cooler is about, the main one I would say is probably that the Mitra thinks she's been assessed or appraised or something like that. When I was a teacher, I left teaching back in, what was it, about 1995 or something like that. And at that point, the British government was introducing a scheme whereby teachers were appraised. And you had various sort of tick boxes, you know, various criteria had to meet. Jaya's nodding, you know what I'm talking about. I managed to escape before that really took off. But teachers were very against it. You know, they really weren't happy to be appraised. But now I think it's very, very common in many, many workplaces that one is assessed and appraised. You have a list of attainment targets or tick boxes. And you, as the person who's been looked at, have to somehow account for yourself using a set formula. And I'm sorry to say that Mitras, sometimes some order members as well, can use the 8 guidelines in this kind of way as a set of attainments or boxes for people to tick. And it's really just not a very creative use of the 8 guidelines. It's really better not to use them like that, I think. One of my friends who's asked me to be a preceptor, been talking about our cooler meetings, and she's been saying, but I have to write an 8 guidelines report, and I don't know what, I'm really resistant. I said, you don't have to write an 8 guidelines report. You don't have to write a report at all. If you want to just record something for us and tell us how you're getting on, or just turn up. You don't have to do anything. There's nothing set in it. You do not have to write an 8 guidelines report. So I think, you know, the 8 guidelines is a tool to help people, well, to help us get a sense of the range of things that a Mitra needs to sort of have alive for it, if you like, in our spiritual life. In order to make our going for refuge effective. It's a tool, but I think we've really got to be quite subtle about how we use it. So, yeah, there isn't a set way of doing cooler meetings, and just going through the 8 guidelines is really not a set way of doing it. If it's working, that's fine, but if it's starting to feel like an assessment or an appraisal, please ditch it. I think the difficulty with this particular pitfall, if you like, is that what can happen with Mitras in this situation, particularly when they're having their first cooler meetings, is that they can get into presenting. They turn up and they sort of, particularly if they have a tendency towards conformism, which a lot of us do, you know, they want to try to show how we're meeting all the criteria, you know. And it makes it very difficult for the cooler meeting to go to depth. You've got to go off-piste, I think, and go into what's live for the Mitra. And that can only happen within the context of the meeting. You can't really predict how that's going to be, I think. Secondly, people can see it, Mitras can see their cooler as their support group. That they, what they can happen, this is a little bit of a parody, but a little bit like this, they gather together the order members who they think are sympathetic to them, and they exclude anybody who they think they aren't, even though that particular order member might have a lot of contact with them and know them quite well. So, and then in that those sorts of cooler meetings, there can be a focus exclusively on encouraging the Mitra, on telling her how well she's doing, and no attention whatsoever is given to any working grounds or difficulties. So it's a bit of a parody, but I'm sure you get the sense of it. It's all about encouragement and rejoicing in merits, which there is definitely a place for, and it needs to happen. But I would like to suggest that at every single cooler meeting, even early on, there could be just a little bit of focus on next steps. It doesn't need to be sort of, you know, pinning the person down and giving them strong criticism, but just even a bit like, oh, what do you think your working grounds are? You know, what could, yeah, a little bit of challenge, yeah. And it can come as a shock for people in that situation when they get a bit closer to ordination, and they need to be having conversations that are more challenging, and which include the perspective of those who aren't close friends but who do know them. They can find that quite difficult, actually. So, you know, again, it's something that can be avoided earlier on if there's just a bit more dialogue, I think, about who's in the cooler and on what basis. So I do think that these pitfalls can be largely avoided if coolers are predominantly order-led. And by that, I don't mean that the Mitra is just a passive participant, but I do think that cooler meetings do need to be led, however subtly, by the people who know what the cooler meeting's about, who know what it means to be ready for ordination, who know what it means to be in the order, i.e. the order members. Don't leave it to the Mitras to lead too much. It's not fair on them. They can't do it. Obviously, we want them to take an active part in it and to have initiative. So, you know, deciding who's in the cooler, how often we meet, what's going to be discussed, how it's going to be discussed. By all means, do it in consultation alongside the Mitra, but don't just leave it to her. Don't just delegate too much to her. I think sometimes we can think, oh, it's empowering for the Mitra if they sort of do it all, but actually it's a bit of a strain for them. It's a particular strain for them if they're landed with the responsibility of getting the cooler to meet. I know that from Mitras. Please, if you can, an order member in the cooler, organise the meeting, where you're going to meet and when, and get the order members together and chase up people who can't make it and all of that. Just make it easy for them. Make it easy for the Mitra. I probably don't need to say this, but I really don't think, in my opinion, you might disagree, by the way, with a lot of what I'm saying, so feel free to, but I really don't think that a Mitra should chair her cooler meeting or take minutes, just to say that. You laugh, but it has happened. So that the way a cooler gathers can set up the conditions for a more creative approach. Well, we'll set up the conditions for a more creative approach. The Mitra doesn't always need to be there, doesn't always need to be a focus on the 8 guidelines. I think we need to, as I'm saying, to include the Mitra in deciding how it'll happen, but for the order to keep the initiative. Yeah. And the last few meetings before she's ordained may well be more of an order meeting to decide if the cooler thinks she's going for effigy effectively. And in that case, as you probably realise, it's best for her to have time without her present. So you can have those discussions. say what's on your mind in a way where you don't have to, censor yourself. Because obviously it's sensitive for her to be there to hear any feedback. So I think as preceptors we can help the Mitra navigate the changing nature of her cooler and train newer order members in what we're doing. And what I'm saying here to us gathered here, is please don't be afraid to take a lead. It's often needed in these circumstances. So an area I'd like to look at in a bit more detail is how we talk about what we're doing in a cooler, the language we use and the framework of thinking that we're operating in. A cooler meeting can only be a creative spiritual practice if we are thinking about it in those terms. So we need the right paradigm. One paradigm I've heard people talk about, Mitras, but also some order members, in relation to the ordination process in general, is talking about power, that it's a power thing, there's a power thing going on. For example, I've heard it said that in this process, the order members have the power, this is putting rather crudely, but anyway, this is the kind of thing, and the Mitra doesn't have it, and this is because the order members have the ability to withhold something that the Mitra wants, i.e. ordination. It's how it can be perceived by Mitras, not surprisingly, but I've also heard an odd older member or two talking in that kind of way. A Mitra can only be ordained when the order members who know them think they're ready, so the order members have a certain power in this dynamic. And I've heard it said that given that this is the case, we as order members need to be aware of the power we have and to be very careful not to misuse it, which in a way might be fair enough, but anyway, thinking about the ordination process in these terms, well, it might work for some order members, it might work for some of you here, you might resonate with this, but I have to say, as you've probably worked out, it doesn't resonate for me, it doesn't work for me. The language of power doesn't ring true or resonate with my experience in these contexts. I think I can see how people come to these conclusions. But it's not the way I think about what I and my friends in the order are about when we are involved with the ordination process or with coolers or our relationships with mitras. It's definitely true that the relationship between the mitras seeking ordination and the order members who are helping them to prepare the order isn't an equal relationship in the sense that everyone has an equal say in what happens next. So in that sense, it's not an equal relationship. And it's also true, I think, that the various order members also involved in the process also don't have an equal say to each other. Mm-hmm. Mm. The private preceptor's view holds more weight than any of the other order members in the Kula, I would say. And of course, the Kula of public preceptors have the final say. It's in a bit of a different way to the private preceptors. At the same time, the public preceptors don't have the power to ordain somebody without the consent of the rest of the order, and neither does a private preceptor have the power to ordain somebody without the consent of the Kula and the local order members. So I was just thinking about, because, you know, this is a gathering of mainly all private preceptors, a few public preceptors thrown in as well. Why is the perspective of the private preceptor, why does that carry more weight than the rest of the Kula? So when somebody's ordained in somebody's ordination process, there is a hierarchy, if you like, in the decision-making process, but it's not a hierarchy of power, it's a hierarchy of responsibility, basically. I missed a bit out. That's right, it was why the private preceptors carry more weight. Yeah. I think this is down to the nature of ordination. So as we know perfectly well, and as I've just been saying, being ready for ordination is not a matter of ticking boxes and ascertaining that a person has fulfilled certain criteria. And the private preceptor is not just one member of a committee who decide jointly if somebody's ready for ordination. That's not what a Kula is. So how do we know if somebody's ready for ordination if it's not a matter of ticking boxes and matching them against criteria? Well, we can only know if somebody's ready for ordination if we resonate with their going for refuge in our own experience. I'm saying these things, you know these things, but I'm just spelling it out. And of course, we do look at the objective factors, and we do listen to the perspectives of a wide variety of order members, and we can have blind spots. But in the private ordination kuti, as private preceptors, we are bearing witness to our confidence in someone's effective going for refuge as it resonates with our own. This is going back to Vajratara's talk from the first day about the Dakini. In a way, we're kind of testifying. We're testifying that that person is going for refuge in a way that we are, and we recognise that in them. It's something intuitive, if you like. And we can only testify or bear witness to it if we really experience it. And when we do that, we have a responsibility. We have a huge responsibility. We don't just have a responsibility to the person who's been ordained. We have a responsibility to the whole order. The whole order needs to trust our perspective when we're sitting there in that kuti. They need to know, particularly because the majority of them, you know, in other parts of the world, even other parts of the country we live in, probably don't know our ordinand well enough to have that resonance. So they need to be able to think, if so-and-so trusts that person's going for refuge, I do too. Basically, that's what they're depending on. We need to be trustworthy within that. And we can only be trustworthy if we're willing to sort of stand in that responsibility, if you like, of resonating with somebody's going for refuge. So as a private preceptor, we can't really ordain somebody that we're not sure is ready, even if the entire order thought they were, even if everybody in the Kula thinks they are, everybody in the local area thinks, if we've got a bit of a doubt, we can't sit in that kuti with them. I've known that happen to a friend of mine who, that she was in that position, and she couldn't go ahead and ordain the person, and said so, and within actually months, the person had sort of effectively left Tree Ratna and joined another Buddhist movement and quite quickly taken ordination into that. But, you know, it was quite interesting how quickly that happened. But other people in the Kula were absolutely convinced that she was ready, and the private preceptor just couldn't do it. You know, there was something just not in place for her. So we have to be able to stand in our own confidence at the end of the day. So in a sense, we too, as, like we say to the ordinand, well, when you have your private ordination, it's you kind of almost like saying that even if you were the only person in the world going for refuge, you would still carry on doing it. And also we need to stand alone as private preceptors in the kuti. There's just us and them, you know. But of course, we're not alone. And as a private preceptor, we can only ordain someone with the consensus of the whole order. So sometimes, you know, sometimes we can fall into, we're very enthusiastic and, you know, we love our ordinand and we see how much they've changed and we're really behind them. And often we're the first person to notice that something significant has shifted, and sometimes it takes others a little bit longer to catch up. And it's difficult, I think, to avoid sometimes getting into championing the preceptee, sort of, you know, being behind them, but in a way that's a little bit behind them at the expense of being behind anybody else, our sisters and brothers in the order who might have different opinions, okay? Or advocating for her. Again, sort of thinking, well, those order members, they don't understand her, and, you know, I've got to sort of, you know, put her point of view and that. And in doing that, we separate ourselves out from the order members who have a different view. We're kind of, in a way, putting ourselves in opposition, however subtly, to order members, just to have a different perspective. And it's you've probably been on the receiving end of that kind of thing. It's not pleasant, is it, if your fellow order member doesn't sort of listen or take into account what you have to say. So I really think we need to avoid doing these sorts of things. I think we really need to listen to other order members' concerns and take them seriously, however behind somebody we are, you know. Otherwise, how else can we expect them to trust us to witness our preceptees going for refuge? They need to know that we are committed to being objective, not that we're committed to just getting what we want or what, you know, for a very good reason, you know, all that kind of thing, very positive to get someone ordained. But ultimately, it can be sort of pushing our own agenda at the expense of other order members. So we really need to not do that. Yes, so as I was saying, it's a hierarchy of not of power, it's a hierarchy of responsibility. I hope this is coming clear why that's the case for private preceptors. So does this mean that the concerns of those who are worried about the misuse of power can be dismissed out of hand? Oh, that's just not what it is. Forget about it. Well, as I said earlier, the language around power doesn't work for me, particularly in this arena. I think, for me, it's just too crude a formula for something, too crude a model, and a bit too fixed. It smacks too much of rigidly delineated positions, maybe a bit like the armed forces or something like that, where everybody's got a fixed rank and, you know, you stick to that kind of thing. And I think it can also tend to lead to a model where some people take on too much responsibility for a process and an outcome, whereas others can renege on their responsibility in an unhelpful way. I mean, we're all adults in these processes, and I do think it's important that everyone takes responsibility, the order members and the mitras, in this process. And I think at worst, it can lead us into a model that Vajrasakhi sometimes talks about of thinking in terms of the world being divided into victims, perpetrators and rescuers. You know, it's if it goes too much down a particular route, it can fall into that. But of course, problems can arise and have arisen in our community where some feel that others have taken action in relation to them without their consent, or where they themselves have lost the ability to express how things look from their perspective or to participate actively in a process. I think that that's definitely the case. We might have experienced it ourselves from time to time, from one end or the other of that spectrum. I think this is a difficulty or a danger which is inherent in the nature of the relationships we're trying to foster with each other in the spiritual community, especially in the ordination process. Kalyana Mitrata relationships, if you like. These sorts of relationships are not common. They're not common currency in the rest of society, if they exist at all these days. So when we come along to Tri Ratna, we are unfamiliar with this sort of model. And we're not necessarily aware of the pitfalls, whichever of those, however much responsibility we have for this decision-making process. So I think because of this, what can sometimes happen is that we can distrust, we can fall into mistrusting the whole model of spiritual hierarchy or vertical Kalyana Mitrata, because we're just afraid that something will go wrong, basically. And we can tend to have more confidence or feel a bit safer if everything's equal or seen to be equal. But actually, I think in doing that, we end up in the wrong model, as I was saying before. I think the extreme of this is when we start to think of, I'm sure nobody in this room thinks like this, but when we start to talk about these things that can happen in these relationships have been abusive. That's the extreme of the, victim, perpetrator, rescuer kind of model. I think it's an extreme position. I think it is possible to have healthy, helpful relationships between people who have different degrees of responsibility in these processes. I think we need to be aware of the pitfalls, and all of us take responsibility for ourselves in this. So all of us who are involved by that. So the nature of the spiritual life is that we're trying to grow our consciousness. We're trying to become more aware, more creative, kinder, wiser than we are at present. And one of the main ways that we do this, if you think of the three jewels, the Sangha refuge, is by being open to the influence of others who are further down the track, who know the territory and who can guide us. So receptivity is a key quality in a Dharma practitioner. And as I was saying earlier on, one of the dangers of this, or one of it's not an easy quality to develop, because we're unfamiliar with how to be receptive in our society, I would say, particularly. I think other societies, well, certainly in India, I think that's less of an issue in the same sort of way. Although, there's obviously dangers in this area for, in all human relationships. So these kind of relationships are new territory for many of us. And by being receptive, in the process of learning to be receptive, I think I've been through this myself, we can end up losing the ground of our own intuition. We can sort of end up giving something away sometimes, not being clear how far out of our own comfort zone we want to go. I mean, spiritual growth does involve going out of one's own comfort zone, and sometimes we are going to need to take the leap and do something that somebody else suggests, which might not feel comfortable. But, sometimes it works out and other times it doesn't. But, that's the territory sort of thing. And we can give ourselves away for a whole load of reasons. We can end up stepping out of our comfort zone in that sort of way for good reasons, because we really do want to try to do something a bit differently. Or we can want to please others, or, whatever. We don't want to be sort of blamed, or we think we're going to get what we desire by doing what others say. I think it really takes a strong individual to be able to be completely receptive to somebody else's suggestions without it being a danger. A little bit like, you remember the Thousand Petal Lotus, when Bhante talks about deciding that he needed to work with the ego. He was coming up against the ego, and he thought that the way, his method for working against his ego was to completely just do whatever Jagdish Kashyap suggested, so he just to sort of open himself to somebody else's will, if you like. And that was how he ended up staying in Kalimpong, you know, for and working for the good of Buddhism for the next 20-odd years or whatever. But I think Bhante was in a position to do that. He had a strong enough individuality, if you like, to... Well, just do something that really wasn't his choice at all, you know, the actual action itself. Yeah. So whose responsibility is it to guard against people giving themselves away in this process? Well, ultimately, the only person who can do this effectively is the person themselves, really, isn't it? Ultimately, the person themselves needs to get to know their own limits, get to know their own tendencies. You know, others can't really do that for them. And to recognise that if they have the tendency, or we have the tendency to give ourselves away or step over something, we need to recognise it and work against it. So basically, you know, it is our work, I think, not to allow ourselves to become a victim. And I'm not saying this in a harsh way. I know this is an easier thing than for some people than for others, but ultimately the only thing that's going to stop us being on the receiving end of things that we really didn't want to be is inner work. We need to know ourselves and be able to guard ourselves against that. So what about order members who are involved with mitras who might have these tendencies to give themselves away a bit? Shouldn't we protect them against themselves from giving themselves away too much? Well, I've got a question here. Is it more helpful for us as order members to become a rescuer, to rescue mitras from this potential danger, or for us to encourage the mitra to do what they need to get to know themselves better and to stand in their own strength? Which is a slightly different approach, isn't it? So what responsibility do order members have, especially private preceptors, who can be seen to be the ones with the power or even blamed when things don't go how the mitra wants? Well, I think that some of this is inevitable anyway, actually. I think it's par for the course. It comes with the job spec, I think, of being a preceptor, that we are going to be blamed sometimes and seen as having power and misusing it. It's inevitable while someone's still in the process of becoming more individual and getting a clear understanding of themselves and getting more of a capacity to communicate with others about themselves in a creative way. But as preceptors, I think we need to be aware that all our actions carry more weight, especially with mitras and less experienced order members, than they used to before we became preceptors. Yeah. And if we are public preceptors, that we need to realise that all our actions carry more weight, especially with mitras and order members, everybody else, than they used to when we weren't public preceptors. So, yeah. And certainly a lot more weight than they would in the eyes of the stranger in the street who has no idea that we're even a Buddhist, let alone a preceptor or whatever. So if we find ourselves reacting, and we invariably will, you know, at times, and if we act out those reactions by speaking or acting in unskillful ways, this will have a bigger negative impact now than the same reaction might have had before. So we can't get away with letting rip with our reactivity. We really just can't get away with it at all. And just to say that reactivity obviously includes things like losing our temper, being grumpy, negative speech, etc. But I think it also involves things like unhelpful or undharmic views, or indulging in craving, or being excessively frivolous. It's all right to be a little bit frivolous, I think, but not excessively. You know, the craving end of the spectrum as well. So we might be thinking, oh God, do I need to be perfect then to be a preceptor? No, of course we don't. We can't. Well, we're not. We're not perfect. But it's more important than ever before not to let unskillfulness go unchecked. We need to be honest about our weaknesses and our shortcomings with our preceptees, as well as with others in the order, other people that we know in the Sangha. Be really open and honest about them, our shortcomings, apologise, confess, etc. It's just really, really important. Ms. Badramati said the other day that she has, she was giving a plug for a regular confession practice, and I would say the same, actually. But Vajrasakhi and I have had a confession stroke reaction practice for, well, we had it for about 4 or 5 years on the phone when she was at T. Ratnaloka and I wasn't, once a week. And then when I moved to T. Ratnaloka, we had it once a week while I was there. And now she's moved away, we still have it on the phone. So we're carrying on. It's just a touchstone. It means that instead of waiting for something really gross to sort of loom up and just be there, I can just notice the sort of more subtle things, or just little sort of, I realise I don't like that person very much, or, oh, there's something going on here, or anyway, anything like that. And you can sort of catch it in its forming, if you like. Very, very helpful. And if we think that somebody might be getting into giving themselves away in relation to us, I think it's just important to check it out explicit and bring it out into the open. Even say something like, look, if you really don't want to do whatever it is, just say, don't just do it because I suggested it. I had an experience with someone who's now in the order, was ordained last year, who was struggling at T. Ratnaloka, and I think her conditioning was, family conditioning was such that she came on retreat, you know, sort of expecting to be kind of scrutinised and, you know, having to sort of prove herself and all of that, and feeling quite uncomfortable about that, you know. And at home, people were thinking, oh, she's doing really well and, you know, looks like she could be ordained soon. And she came to T. Ratnaloka and she just wasn't able to be herself and relax and be normal in the group and stuff like that. It's just quite difficult. So, of course, we have to say, well, it was a bit further to go. And anyway, I thought it was during lockdown started shortly after that. And I thought, I think I needed to contact her just to talk about what it was that I thought needed a bit more time. And I just decided to keep going with her and have phone calls with her every couple of weeks while we were during lockdown and I was staying with my mother. So we would just have a chat every couple of weeks. I thought, well, she'll just get to know me a bit and hopefully that way she'll relax a bit around me, see me a bit as a person, you know, like her. And there was a particular time when we'd had a chat and I'd said something or other. I mean, I don't know what I say half the time. I'm an extrovert, so Tara Vandenberg will tell you that means speak, think, speak, rather than introverts do think, speak, think, apparently. So I sort of say things, and then afterwards I think, do I really think that? Oh, no, I'll change my mind or whatever. Anyway, I've been doing this kind of thing, and she's not like this at all, this lady. She's quite an introvert. And I got a message from her the next day saying, oh, you know, could we have a phone call to check something out that I'd said? And I thought, oh, God, this is going to be a bit harder work than I thought. It's going to involve more communication than I realised. But I thought, well, just do it anyway. Anyway, so we had a talk and she said, oh, you said such and such. And I said, did I? And she said, yes. And I wondered what you meant. I said, oh, to be honest, I don't remember what I meant. I said, look, just don't take what I say so seriously. You know, don't worry. I tend to sort of think aloud and that. You know, don't worry about what I think, you know. I just sort of said that to her explicitly. And after that, actually, something just dropped. She just seemed to relax. I think she just needed to hear that she didn't have to worry about what I thought. Which, some people, you have to give them the opposite message, don't you? But with, you know, please can you take what I say a bit more seriously? But, you know, with some people, particularly people with those tendencies, just to be encouraged, just not to take everything that their preceptor and the people at T. Ratnaloka say to heart, you know. Yeah, so I think it's important that we do what we can to debunk unhelpful projections, to, you know, catch them, see them and debunk them. But I think that we can't ensure that these dynamics won't arise. I think they are par for the course because of this working out of a new sort of relationship that most of us haven't encountered before. And also it's different with each person, with each preceptee. So you can't just have this model, oh, it's a power model kind of thing, because, you know, some people don't experience it like that at all. You know, it's different. And if difficulties arise, instead of attributing it to unequal power in the relationship, I think it would be more helpful to find ways of encouraging the Mitra to step more fully into responsibility for themselves in a positive way, and, you know, gently and kindly, not in a kind of way. But this is a journey, you know, because it takes time for people to get to know themselves. And for some people, as we said before, they have more conditioning that works against that than others. So, you know, but I think that's the answer, really. And at the same time, as preceptors, as order members, taking full responsibility for our own reactivity and any reactivity that gets triggered in relationships to mitras or in coolers or etc., and to learning to work with our reactive tendencies more and more effectively. So going back to my conversation with the mitras in Croydon, saying coolers can be challenging and coolers can be very positive, yeah, of course it's true of any communication between human beings. So coolers are a practice for us all. I've made that point, and not a fixed thing, not a set thing. And when they go well, which can often happen just before someone's invited to be ordained, they can feel very, very uplifting and inspiring. As the effective going for refuge of everyone present, including the mitra, interacts to create something that's greater than the sum of its parts. Well, you get a sense of the third order of consciousness in those meetings, don't you? Or even a little taste of the bodhicitta, actually. Because in those moments, what's happening, particularly if the mitra's there, which she usually is for bits of those meetings, effectively what's happening is that she's stepping into the order. And what's happening is that the communication in the cooler has been a significant condition for her to learn how to do this, to learn how to be in the order. It's almost like a sense of Avalokiteshvara manifesting between those present, just a sort of a glimpse or something. So if we approach cooler meetings in this spirit and talk about them in these terms right from the start, I think they will evolve in this direction. And as most of us know from our order life, particularly since, I was ordained in 1999 and coolers were just getting going at the LBC at that time, and then the whole cooler system came into being very fully after that. It's a huge part of what it means to be in the women's wing of the order, isn't it? And some of the guys are also involved in our coolers. And I think it's a huge order practice. It's not just a businessy thing that we do to get people ordained or whatever. It's a huge practice. And it really is an opportunity each time we have those meetings to bring Avalokiteshvara into being or to help the mundane Sangha start to become the Arya Sangha.
Well, there's so much in that talk. I've made absolutely loads of notes to really reflect on and talk about in our discussion groups, which I think would be very, very helpful. I think coolers is an area for people that they do struggle with quite a lot sometimes and need. In a way, we are developing something, you know, and we're developing it all the time. And I think that talk will substantially help that development, actually, of the cooler system within precepting and ordination training. And I think the thing that struck me was you saying, well, it can be quite a kind of new way of communicating, a new relationships or series of relationships that we may be unfamiliar with in our lives. I was sort of thinking, well, what models do I have in my life, you know, that bear similarities? And I thought, oh, well, it's very easy, isn't it, to kind of go from That somehow you're someone's teacher, or the coolers are like a kind of teacher, teaching scenario or appraisal scenario, and swing between that, and then we're all pals, and neither of them ring quite true. So I think it's quite helpful to think about what have I got a model in my mind that I'm sort of putting onto this, because. In a way, yes, it might be new. It might be a new series of relationships. Here we are with the Buddhist tradition, making the Buddhist tradition available to us and our own lives, with our own relationships with people and our own background and conditioning, whatever that may be. So, I just think that was really helpful and really good food for reflection and thought and discussion. And behind it all, this excellent vision of the potential of cooler meetings, which, you know, I think we've all touched on occasionally. And I think one of the things also is it can be a really delightful way to get to know other order members in a creative setting where I might not have met people before. So I feel like I'm really enthusiastic about cooler meetings. Sometimes I don't. It really has made me think, if we thought about it differently, if we thought about the paradigm differently, it would affect the way we go into them as well. So thank you very much, Shantavadri, for sharing those thoughts with us.